chapter 4. It's a little bit windy, so I'm not sure I'm going to stay out here, but we'll see how it goes. "I think you have an admirer," said Mrs. Pusey, with a light laugh. Edith made no reply, nor it seemed was she required to do so. For Mrs. Pusey, in an almond green linen coat and skirt, and wearing her daytime pearls, had turned away from her to summon Marie-Yvonne. More hot water was needed. Tea was being served, and to Edith's surprise, it was being served to a number of people whom she had not seen before. More young waiters than she had previously noticed were busy at tables filled by groups of men in high good humour, animated by cordial discussion. One or two looked up as she passed, then returned to the more urgent matter of business that had brought them here from the conference in Geneva, for a last informal meeting before they all went their separate ways. For the first time, Edith was aware of the hotel as a well-populated organism, its attendants merely resting until an appropriate occasion should summon them to present themselves. Serious and anxious to give service at an appointed time, that time, it seemed, had now arrived. Monsieur Hubert, at the desk, getting in the way of his son-in-law, smiled, nodded, and suggested different alterations to the menu for dinner. To this scene of animation, her nose wrinkling slightly at the unusual smell of cigarette smoke, came Mrs. Pusey, late as usual, and perhaps a little tired after a day which had not yielded the required amount of shopping. They had been after a particular kind of blouse with drawn threadwork, she explained to Edith, who was drawn to Mrs. Pudsey's table from her own by some magnetic force. But there had been disappointment. The little woman who used to make the blouses had just disappeared without giving them any sort of notice, although she was well aware that Mrs. Pusey and Jennifer came over every year and always gave her a substantial order, and sent her a Christmas card. "But there you are," said Mrs. Pusey. "The old days of service have disappeared, even in Switzerland. It's not my world any longer," she gave a little smile. "No, everything has changed, and not for the better either. But one thing I will not do is lower my standards. I have always striven for the best. It's an instinct, I suppose, as my husband used to say. Only the best is good enough." "Mummy," cried Jennifer hotly, "you are the best." She grasped her mother's hand, and both sets of eyes took on a grave glistening of the recently bereaved, although even if the bereavement was occasioned by the disloyal specialist in drawn thread work, Edith reflected there was a little she could offer in way of consolation. While the, to her, extraordinary communion between mother and daughter was demonstrated once again, she studied Jennifer, who always seemed to her as expansive as a blank window, although all her gestures were vigorous and all her interventions emphatic. Jennifer was a splendid specimen, she acknowledged, an effortless testimonial to her mother's care. Her large, fair face, perhaps a little too sparsely populated by a cluster of rather small features, shone with the ruddy health of an unsuspecting child. Everything about her gleamed, her light blue eyes, her regular, slightly incurving teeth, her faultless skin, all gave off various types of sheen. Her blonde hair looked almost dusty in comparison. Her rather plump, artless body was, Edith thought, set forth by clothes which were far from artless and possibly too narrow. Jennifer managed to give the impression that she was growing out of them. Everything about her was expensive as her mother's money could make, but in a different style from Mrs. Pusey's careful elegance. In her navy linen suit and her perhaps too tight white jersey, Jennifer was determinedly gemmy. Edith wondered how old she was. She looked very young, as did Mrs. Pusey, but in a way she could not define they were both out of date. They referred almost constantly to times gone by, times illuminated by glamour, happiness, success, confidence and security, times of necessity, remote and mysterious to their interlocutor. Edith reflected how enormously one-sided conversations with the Puseys were always likely to be. They imposed their past as deliberately as they did their present, and to both of these one was expected, in some curious way, to pay homage. They required no information at all. Once they had assured themselves that Edith was alone, they had requisitioned her, and this was not only a kindness but a convenience, proof to Edith's mind of sophisticated thinking. And, as most of Mrs. Pusey's sentence began with the word, "of course," they had a range of tranquil confidence which somehow oculated any attempt to introduce an opinion of her own. Occluded any attempt to introduce any opinion of her own. She found all this amusing and very restful. The last thing she wanted to do was to talk about herself. No, that was that. But she confessed to herself that she was somewhat disturbed by Jennifer's cheerful but steady refusal of any kind of mutuality. After all, she thought, we are almost of an age, although she is a few years younger. She might be, what, 32, 33, possibly 34? And yet she belongs to her mother, as if her mother had been cast upon an uncaring and philistine world, and it was Jennifer's duty to protect her from it. What Jennifer felt about these few people were likely to find out, Edith thought, as she observed, whilst Mrs. Pusey was talking, Jennifer's uninflected smile. At this point in her musing, she was disturbed by a pleasant male voice saying, "Don't lose this," and offering her the notebook, which must have slipped from her lap unnoticed while she was contemplating Jennifer. Startled, she looked up to see a tall man in a light grey suit smiling down at her. She murmured her thanks, expecting him to go away. She could hardly ask him to sit down and join them. "But are you a writer?" he inquired, in a voice very slightly tinged with amusement, as if he knew, thought Edith in some confusion, although the idea that anyone could be a writer in a place like this was not likely to be taken seriously, or so she hoped. She gave a distracted smile intended to deflect further questions, and still looking amused, he moved away and followed his friends or colleagues out, away from the tea tables, into the fresh air. "It seems you have an admirer," said Mrs. Pusey, and when more hot water arrived, she added, "He's had his eye on you since you came in. I saw it at once." She spoke roughishly, but her eyelids drooped as if this merely added to the day's disappointment. Jennifer, Edith saw, was still glassily smiling. It was time to go up and change, and yet they lingered on. Edith felt constrained by the kind of loyalty to wait upon Mrs. Pusey, although it was not clear to her why loyalty was involved. Their silence was ruminative. "No confidences were to be offered or exchanged. Just what I wanted," Edith reminded herself. But what she suddenly longed to do was to speak to David. The intrusion of a man into her consciousness, however parodic, had had the painful effect of awakening her longing. She glanced at her watch, calculating the time anxiously. If she rushed upstairs now, she might just catch him before he left. At the rooms, she thought, with a pang of love and terror. "I must be getting back to the rooms," were the first words she had consciously heard him say, and she was struck by their mystery. She turned the amazing sentence over in her mind, conjuring up vistas of courtyards with fountains trickling and silent servants in gauze trousers bringing sherbet. Or possibly a large divan in whitewashed houses shuttered against the heat of the afternoon. Or dreaming, glowing, idleness inspired by Delacroix. Or of grave merchants with clicking amber beads in coffee houses below pavement's level. Opium dens, Turkish baths, a tiled hammam, its walls bright with coins of light reflecting from the water. Peace. "What do you do?" she inquired, her eyes wide with this vision, gazing off into the middle distance. "I am an auctioneer," he replied. and then there had been a brief silence. They had met at one of her friends, Penelope Mills, irritating little parties. Drinks before lunch next Sunday, came the inexorable voice over the telephone. Now don't let me down. You can work in the afternoon if you want to. I'm not stopping you. But you are, thought Edith, since you are too mean to provide any food, and since I don't care to eat at 2:30 or whenever I get back with a splitting headache, my day is effectively ruined. And Penelope had such a curious attitude to providing food. She regarded it as some sort of unseemly submission. Her company could only be purchased via the old and horsey routes of flowers, theatre tickets, and intimate dinners at the best restaurants, of which she was a connoisseur. To Penelope, men were conquest, attributes, but they were also enemies. They belonged to species that must never be granted more than the amount of time and attention she considered as they deserved. Her tone with such men was flirtatious, mocking, never serious. She spread about her a propaganda of rapid affairs, rapidly consummated with a laughing lack of commitment on both sides. She seemed to take pride in the steady succession of names. She was, Edith saw, accomplished in venery, and as an accompaniment she was given to sighing elaborately over Edith's uneventful life, and was clearly of the opinion that Edith only wrote about the pleasures that reality had denied her. She was generous with offers to introduce Edith to various grass widowers of her acquaintance. My cast-offs, she said laughingly, referring to them, and was piqued when Edith pleaded that she was really no company when she was working on a book. She would have taken pleasure, Edith knew, in setting up a meeting with herself present. She would have masterminded Edith with many a jocund reference to her own successes with the amiable candidate. She would even have ushered them off the premises to a restaurant of her own choosing, would have whispered something in the cast-off's ear, and then said firmly to Edith, "I'll ring you in the morning." Yet she considered men to be a contemptible sex, and her eye would sparkle when she recounted tales of conquest at the various committee meetings, which were the very stuff of her social life. "That dreadful little man," she would say dismissively of someone who did not know the rules of her game. She was a handsome woman of 45 and would remain so for many years. She and Edith had in common the disposition of their houses, for they were at opposite ends of a tiny terrace. Their domestic arrangements, which consisted of a window cleaner, not to be missed, they had each other's key, and Mrs. Dempster, their dramatic and unpredictable cleaning lady. There was an understanding between them that if either were ill, the other would shop and cook. This last contingency had not yet arisen, but was of a comfort to them both. Edith, tired, yawning, aching from her silent day, would push away her typewriter, wander out of her house and into Penelope's, and be quite happy to advise her on what to wear on her next sortie. Penelope, thought, though never referring to the matter of Edith's work, would push her forward as if she were a child, at her all-too-frequent parties, and say, "Of course you know Edith Hope, she writes." Such was their friendship. On this particular Sunday, Penelope had drummed up a good attendance, and there were many people there whom Edith did not know. She resigned herself to standing around for the requisite amount of time. Penelope did not like one to sit down. When the resonant sentence floated into her consciousness, tracing it to its source, she saw a tall, lean, foxy man helping himself to peanuts. She saw from his back that he was restless, impatient, and burning to get away. Any excuse would do. Hence his implausible remark, which was followed rather too fluently in the teeth of Penelope's protest by an account of the late catalogue entry which demanded his urgent attention. Edith, still filled with her vision of the hammam, the Arab cafe, the Mediterranean siesta, murmured somewhat distractedly as he made his determined way to the door. "Could you describe these rooms to me?" He contemplated her from a considerable height, down a long nose. "A 5-story warehouse in Chapman Street," he said. Then she looked up at him, and they exchanged a level glance from which all expression was studiously absent. She lowered her eyes, and he left. Nothing more was said. Later, she was helping Penelope to wash the glasses. She had asked, "That tall man, what does he do?" "David Simmons. He's head of a family business now. Simmons, the auction house. They handle a lot of bigger country house sales. Rather a pet, isn't he? He's always been a bit keen on me, but he's so hard to get hold of these days. He asked about you, by the way." "How do you know him?" said Edith. "I was at school with his wife," said Penelope. "Priscilla, you know. You've met her here a dozen times. You know Edith, tall, blonde, very good-looking. She couldn't come today." Edith did remember her, tall, blonde, very good-looking, a woman with rather insolent air of authority, a carelessness, a loud, confident voice. She had once encountered her in the china department at Peter Jones and had noticed the way she bounced along trailing an assistant like a favoured senior girl in a school common room. Penelope removed her gloves, apron, imprinted with the advertisement for Guinness, and pegged it up her rubber gloves. "Now, Edith, I'm afraid I'm going to have to turn you out. Richard said he would come back and take me out to lunch round the corner." Edith, at her window, watched Richard turn up, sprint down the road with commendable elasticity. Spry, she thought, jaunty, good check suit, straining slightly over wide back. Veined hand-waving, she pictured David and smiled involuntarily. She sat down to wait for him. When he came, and she knew he would, 2 or 3 hours later, they said nothing but looked at each other long and hard. In bed, they fell instantly into the warm mutual sleep, arms around each other, and when they woke almost simultaneously, they had laughed with pleasure. After that, it seemed as if she knew everything about him. The only revelation was his delightful and constant appetite. She took to keeping the house full of food. They were sensible people. No one was to be hurt. She prided herself on giving nothing away, so that he never knew of her empty Sundays, the long, eventful evenings, the holidays cancelled at the last minute. Cursing inwardly as he loaded the car for the long journey back to Suffolk, after another crowded and inharmonious weekend. He thought of her little house, its quality of silence, the green dimness of her drawing room. She, too early in bed, thought of him with his family, their habits, their quarrels, their treats, of his children. And thinking of this yet again in the Hôtel du Lac, she felt the ache in her throat that preceded tears. But she was so good at concealing them, and murmuring an excuse to Mrs. Pusey, she took the unprecedented step of leaving the salon before her. She would make no telephone call. She was, after all, if not still in disgrace, working out her probation. The tears that had fallen from her fine light eyes seemed to have sharpened her vision. When, some 2 hours later, she sat down to dinner, she was aware that the lights were brighter, the room more live with personalities, the tables full. It was agreeable to see men after days in this gynecium bringing the place to life, to see waiters speeding to their command. The man in grey who had picked up a notebook half rose as she took her seat, nodded, and then applied his attention to the removal of the backbone from his soul. The woman with the dog looked amazing in a floating flowered chiffon dress, its narrow straps tied into 2 tiny bows on the beautiful bones of her ivory shoulders. Edith was grateful for the warmth, the food, the service. She felt very tired and thought that she would sleep soundly that night. Mrs. Pusey, in her black chiffon, stood hesitantly in the doorway, as if overcome by the excitement, hardly daring to make her way unaccompanied to her table. Jennifer, standing mildly behind her. It was only when Monsieur Hubert came forward, gallantly holding out his hand, that Mrs. Pusey broke into a smile and allowed herself to be led forward. The woman with the dog let out a snort, which Mrs. Pusey chose not to hear. Edith, once again anonymous and accepting her anonymity, made an appropriately inconspicuous exit, and, sitting in the deserted salon, the first to arrive from the dining room, she felt her precariously dignity hard-pressed and about to succumb in the light of her earliest sadness. The pianist, sitting down to play, gave her a brief nod. She nodded back, thought how limited her means of expression had become, nodding to the pianist or to Madame de Bonneuil, listening to Mrs. Pusey, using a disguised voice in the novel she was writing, and with all of this, waiting for a voice that remained silent, hearing very little that meant anything to her at all. The dread implications of this condition made her blink her eyes and vow to be brave, to do better, not to give way, but it was not easy. Drinking her coffee in the salon, Edith felt purged by the grief, obedient and childlike, as she had on so many occasions, reaching back into the mist of childhood, to that visit, perhaps, to the Kunsthistorisches Museum with her father, and childishly anxious to please, she went forward when the signal came to join the Puseys at their table. The man in grey had positioned himself nearby, and although purporting to read a newspaper, was almost visibly listening to their conversation. Perhaps a detective, thought Edith, without much interest. "You know, my dear," said Mrs. Pusey, after she had repaired her face and received compliments on her appearance, "you remind me of someone. Your face is very familiar. Now, who could it be?" "Virginia Woolf," offered Edith, as she always did on these occasions. Mrs. Pusey took no notice. "It'll come to me in a minute," she said. "You two girls talk among yourself." And she placed the thumb of her forefinger of her right hand to the bridge of her nose, assuming an expression of such gravity that Jennifer, always on the lookout, stopped listening to what Edith was saying and turned her attention to her mother. Edith lay back in her chair and listened to the pianist, who was being ignored by everyone else until she was aware of Jennifer's face being lowered into her sight line. "Mummy says she wants to watch television, so we're going upstairs." She turned back to her mother and watched the always difficult negotiation from seated to standing position. Again, Edith wondered about her age. At the door, Mrs. Pusey turned dramatically and said, "I've remembered. I've remembered who Edith reminds me of." Edith observed a slight spasm contract on the back of the man in grey, still behind his newspaper. "Princess Anne," cried Mrs. Pusey. "I knew it would come to me. Princess Anne."